Okay, so I'm going to talk about quantization of Kauser diamonds in 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity. We all know there are many challenges in quantizing, canonically quantizing gravity, such as the nonlinearity of the constraints and the phase space, absence of local observables, the fact that it's non-renormalizable perturbatively in dimensions bigger than 3, and the problem of time, where often time is time evolution is a gauge transformation. So it's worth to explore the non-perturbative quantization of gravity in simplified settings. And here we'll consider a two-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert gravity with a non-positive cosmological constant. And by that, I mean the class of space-times that we're going to consider are the domain of dependence of a topological disk. So essentially, we have a disk. You put some metrics and some extrinsic curvatures on that disk that satisfy the constraints of general relativity. And you take the maximal development of that initial data, and that defines a Kauser diamond. And you want to quantize the class of all such spacetimes. We do consider a boundary condition on the class of spatial metrics that you are allowed to give, and that is that we fix the induced metric on the boundary of that disk to be some fixed gamma. There are two basic approaches to quantize a gauge theory. One is to first quantize the theory and then deal with the constraints at the quantum level. The other is to first impose the constraints at the classical level and remove the associated gauge ambiguities. And then we quantize the resulting gauge-free theory.
So metric on the boundary, do you fix it modulo diffeomorphisms of the boundary, or you just fix them?
Yeah, well, in that language, I'm just fixing it pointwise, not modulo diffeomorphisms. Yeah, so here we are going to follow the second approach, the reduced phase space approach. So some similar things have been done for closed spacetimes, which leads to finite dimensional reduced phase space. And we want to introduce a boundary and in such a way that, and we want to understand better gravity in quasi-local settings. And Kauser diamonds are the natural objects to look at. And we also want to have some good handle on the problem. And that's why we go to low dimensions, three dimensions, which gives us better control without making the problem too trivial. The phase space we found is still infinite dimensional because of the boundary. Okay, so a summary of the contents. So first I'm going to discuss this constant mean curvature gauge fixing of time. Then we will solve the constraints and remove the gauge ambiguities. Then very briefly talk about the Hamiltonian on the reduced phase space that generates time evolution between those CMCs. And then we're going to talk about the canonical quantization using Isham's method, and a little bit about the representation theory and some properties of like the twist and some other things. So in general relativity, there's a gauge associated with both time and space diffeomorphisms. But when we have boundary, we need to be careful to what happens near those boundaries. Because some things that would naively be gauge may be promoted to actual transformations between distinct physical states. And in this case, we see that the condition of fixing the induced metric on the corner implies that all changes in the foliation are, in fact, gauge. And for this class of spacetimes, there is a universal and natural choice of gauge fixing, which is given by these constant mean curvature, or CMC, surfaces. So basically here, each one of those surfaces are defined by having a constant trace of the extrinsic curvature k. And as k runs from plus infinity to minus infinity, those surfaces run through the whole diamond and defines a well-defined foliation. And for example, the non-positivity of the cosmological constant is important here. So this provides a very convenient gauge fixing for time.
So what does it mean to these surfaces? I mean, they don't seem to move as boundary. Is that automatically given in this gauge?
So, sorry, what?
The way you draw through the surfaces, they don't move the boundary.
Yes.
Is that automatically satisfied? If they have
Because they are defined as being attached to the boundary, and then the condition is that the trace of the extrinsic curvature is a given constant value. So then that fixes a unique surface.
Oh, okay, so it's consistent with the gauge condition.
Yes. Okay, so then we can decompose the extrinsic curvature into its trace-free part, sigma, and its trace full part, which depends on the time parameter. And in that gauge, the constraints of general relativity are reduced to those two. So the momentum constraint is the statement that sigma AB is divergenceless with respect to the spatial metric. And we also have the Hamiltonian constraint, which relates the scalar curvature, the spatial metric, with this quadratic term involving sigma, and this chi parameter, which is a time-dependent constant, depending on the cosmological constant and on the time parameter tau.
So just a question there. If lambda was positive, then the unicity will still hold as long as chi is positive.
The what? So what would it still hold?
The reconstruction, the unicity. The condition you're really needing is not lambda negative, it's chi positive.
Yeah, so I'm going to explain very soon why we need positive chi. Okay, so and then there's a very convenient method to solve the constraints in this setting, which is the Lichtenhoff method. So here, we want to the momentum constraint is the easiest of the two. It's a linear one. The problem is the Hamiltonian constraint. So we want to start with what I call seed data, which is a pair of a spatial metric and a trace-free extrinsic curvature that satisfy the momentum constraint, also satisfy the boundary condition, but not necessarily the Hamiltonian constraint. And we want to deform this set of data in such a way that the deformed data will satisfy all the constraints. And we can do that via a Weyl transformation. So we apply this Weyl transformation, e to the phi on the metric, and e to minus 2 phi on sigma. And the reason for this minus 2 is because we want that as we do this transformation, we do not destroy the momentum constraint, which we already had. We also want to only consider phi, which vanishes at the boundary, so that it also preserves the boundary condition. And then the Hamiltonian constraint is expressed as a single equation for the Weyl parameter phi. So this is an elliptic nonlinear equation, and it's called the Lichtenhoff equation. Now note that chi appears as one term of this equation, and here's where we want it to be positive, or at least non-negative, because when chi is non-negative, it's possible to show that this equation always has one and only one solution.
What was tau again?
Tau is the time parameter, which is minus k, the trace of the continuous curvature for each.
Yeah, the
maximal surface.
Yeah, if you want this one.
So the fact that it has one solution is a statement of consistency. It means that we can solve the constraints after we put ourselves into this gauge. And the uniqueness condition is important for the following, in the following argument. Suppose you start with a pair of seed data, H and sigma, and you use that as an input for the Lichanowicz method. It will produce a set of valid data, so data that satisfy the constraints. Now suppose that you do an arbitrary value transformation analogous to the one we considered before, where lambda vanishes at the boundary, so it preserves the boundary condition. And you decide to use this as a new input and run the Lichanowicz method for this data. You will obtain a single set of valid data, which is the same one as you would have obtained starting from this. This means that any element of this equivalence class that we start with as an input, you produce the same output, the same set of valid data. So you can think of this as parametrizing the constraint surface. So all the set of all the set of all valid initial data. So satisfying both constraints. But we still have to remove gauge ambiguity, because every spatial diffeomorphism that acts trivially at the boundary is a gauge transformation. So we can take that equivalence class and further quotient by this diffeomorphism, and that will correspond to the reduced phase space, which is the space of physically inequivalent classical states. You can also note that this set of equivalence classes can be identified with the cotangent bundle of the space of conformal geometries of the disk. So T star Q, where Q is equivalence of matrix related by a diffeo and a vio transformation in such a way that both the diffeo and the vio transformation are trivial at the boundary. Now, there is a simple argument for finding out what Q is, but in view of time, I think I'm going to skip it. But the conclusion is that you identify Q as this space, which is diff plus S1 mod PSL 2R, where diff plus S1 is the group of orientation-preserving diffeomorphisms on the circle, and PSL2R, which is the projective special linear group in two real dimensions, is a three-dimensional subgroup of diff S1. Okay, and so the reduced phase space is the cotangent bundle of that space.
Is it sitting canonically in diff S1?
Yes, well, as a subgroup, yes. So, all right. An interesting comment is that there is a non-trivial symplectomorphism from this phase space to the reduced phase space of pure asymptotically ADS3, which is essentially Q times Q. Instead of T star Q. So that is quite interesting. Let me very briefly mention an alternative approach to the reduction process based on a convenient change of coordinates. So here we note that every metric on a disk is conformally equivalent to any other metric on the disk, provided that you allow the conformal transformation to act non-trivially at the boundary. So you can think of any metric, any physical metric on the Cauchy slice, as being produced by some conformal transformation on a reference metric. You can take this, for example, to be the flat unit disk. And for any sigma on the physical disk, you can essentially pull back under this conformal transformation to define a sigma bar here. So this gives a change of, essentially a change of coordinates between the physical things, H and sigma, to those conformal coordinates. So a diffeomorphism on the disk, a function lambda on the disk, and a traceless symmetric tensor on that disk. And that's interesting because in those coordinates, by looking at the symplectic form, the gate directions become evident. So it's very natural to do the reduction process in those coordinates. And we end up with a natural system of coordinates on the reduced phase space. And since we have the map, this quotient map from the physical variables to those variables describing the reduced phase space, this is useful when interpreting the geometrical meaning of quantum observables, which are defined on the reduced phase space. Okay, so we know that in two plus one dimensions, there are no local degrees of freedom in gravity. But we got a reduced phase space, which is quite large. It's infinite dimensional. And so what are all those states? Well, we know that every diamond is locally ADS, or Minkowski, if lambda were zero. And therefore, and since the Cauchy slice has a trivial topology, it means that it embeds as a subregion, as a causal diamond region of global ADS spacetime.
What would you do if you do a non-trivial topology? Like, if can you say something about BTZ? If you were to assume your Cauchy slice has this topology that gives
BDZ
black holes.
Yeah, it would be interesting to consider this, but in this procedure, we only consider.
But
since the diamond is a finite region, its global shape is a physical observable, right? So this diamond here looks different than that other one there. But the diamond can be described only by giving the how the its corner embeds into ADS, right? Because then you can take any surface filling in and then take the domain of dependence of that, and that will determine the diamond. So you can think of this phase space as a space of a loop with fixed length that can be embedded into ADS3 as the boundary of a space-like disk. Here, we have some pictures showing that the different points in the reduced phase space really correspond to that. So here, for example, you take a point in phase space, and you can construct an explicit map that will show how this diamond is embedded, or the corner is embedded into ADS. You can have many different shapes. And here are some fun pictures produced with Mathematica, just to see what's the typical shape of those diamonds. So I'm not considering just like pretty pointy like diamonds, but all those classes of causal diamonds. Okay, so we can briefly talk about the Hamiltonian that generates time evolution between those CMC slices. To do that, you can essentially write the action in the canonical form. where P and Q here are variables, conjugated variables in the reduced phase space. And then you can identify whatever remains as your Hamiltonian. And what we get has a very simple geometric interpretation. The Hamiltonian is time dependent and is equal to the area of the CMC with that corresponding K. However, you see that in this expression here, it depends on this integral of exponential of lambda. And lambda here is supposed to be solution of that complicated Lichanowicz equation. So despite having a simple geometric interpretation, its actual expression in terms of reduced phase space variables is actually very complicated. We can try to look at play with the different scales we have to see if there's a regime where it simplifies.
Just a question about the Hamiltonian. Is it time dependent?
Right? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Right. So you have those scales: the corner length, the ADS length, and the Planck length. One special regime is when the corner length is much bigger than the ADS length, and also holds for very early or late times, and for states sufficiently close to the symmetric diamond, which is the one where its Cauchy slice is a Poincaré disk. We have a Hamiltonian that is essentially free or quadratic in momentum. Okay, but so that's okay, enough with approximations. Now we'll go back to exact things. And we wish to now we wish to quantize our phase space. This phase space is somewhat non-trivial in the sense that there is no natural global system of coordinates. So we must be careful with the quantization. And just to give a simple example, suppose you're trying to quantize a particle that lives on a half line. So the configuration space is R plus. And the phase space is the cotangent band of that, so it's R plus times R. And you can put coordinates X and P that satisfy the usual Poisson bracket. But now suppose that you try to quantize it in such a way that those X and P are represented by self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space, satisfying that canonical commutation relation. Then P can be exponentiated to e to minus iap, and that acts as a translation of eigenvalues of x. But in this formula, a can be any real number. And so in particular, it can be arbitrarily negative, which means that if x has positive eigenvalues, it will also have negative eigenvalues. So this is an improper quantization of that system. So then we proceed to a slightly more sophisticated quantization scheme proposed by Chris Isham, which basically translates into the following. Find a transitive group of symplectic symmetries of the phase space, and then construct the quantum theory based on unitary, irreducible, projective representations of that group. To understand what's happening, why this works, is the following. So for every element of the algebra of this group, it can be associated to a Hamiltonian charge on the phase space. And the Poisson algebra of these charges is homomorphic to the Lie algebra of that group. There might be central charges, but if that happens, you just need to centrally extend that group and start again with this extended group, and now you find a true homomorphism between those two algebras. in the transitiveness of the group, transitive meaning any two points in the phase space can be connected by at least one group element. This implies that this set of charges is complete in the sense that any observable can be locally expressed in terms of them. So now that you have this closed algebra of complete observables, you can proceed with the usual scheme. So essentially replace the Poisson brackets to commutators and try to find unitary irreducible representations of that algebra. Okay, so now we wish to apply this to our phase space, which is a cotangent bundle of diff plus S1 mod PSL2R. A natural place to start is to note that the configuration space is a homogeneous space for diff plus S1, right? So diff plus S1 has a natural transitive action on this space of equivalence classes. And if we have this action on the configuration space, it naturally leads to an action on the cotangent bundle. Why? Because suppose you take you have a point x on the configuration space that is mapped to some x prime, then any one form p here can be mapped to a one form here by doing the inverse pullback, right? So this essentially gives a horizontal action on this cotangent bundle, and this action is symplectic. Okay, but we need to find a group that acts transitively on the phase space, and this only acts horizontally. So we need to extend the group by somehow adding vertical translations. So here describe how what those momentum translations could be. There's a natural way to define those, and it's as follows. Suppose we have a group K acting on the configuration space, on a configuration space Q. And suppose we can find a representation of K that, in such a way that at least one orbit of this action in the vector space V is homeomorphic to Q. So then you can essentially think of Q as embedded into this vector space in which this space K is represented as some orbit. Now, if you pick any element W of the dual of V, then it naturally defines a one-form field on Q. How? So suppose this is Q and you pick a point here. So it can be represented as being at the endpoint of some vector V in this vector space. Any tangent vector at this point can be also thought as a vector in V. Now, if you just pick this dual element and act on C, you return a number. And you return a number at every point. So it defines a one-form field on Q. Okay, so now that for every W you have a one-form field, you can define a momentum translation in the natural way. So if you take a point P that's a one-form at some point X, you can simply subtract pointwise this one-form field W from that point. So it essentially define a vertical translation on the whole cotangent bundle. And this action is symplectic. And moreover, it together with the action of the horizontal action that we described before, they form a group that acts transitively on the phase space. So let us apply this to our case. So the first thing we note is that at least we could not find any representation where the group diff plus S1 would have an orbit homeomorphic to diff S1 mod PSL2R. However, it turns out that, and that is well known, that the coadjoint representation of the Virasoro group has, on its dually algebra, does have an orbit that is isomorphic to diff S1 mod PSL2R. And the Virasoro group is just a central, it's just an extension of diff plus diff S1 by a central direction, R. So we could have just as well taken Virasoro as the starting group generating the horizontal translations, simply by defining that the central element of Virasoro acts trivially on the phase space. And so now we can apply that this procedure to find a transitive group on this phase space. So it's essentially a semi-direct product of Virasoro together with those momentum translations. Those momentum translations are abelian. So it's essentially a group that is a group semi-direct product with some abelian piece. And that is a natural group to consider. OK. We can also discuss the algebra of that group. So the algebra of the Virasoro factor is just the Virasoro algebra. And the algebra of the momentum translation part is commutative, because that abelian, well, because it's an abelian factor. But it's isomorphic as a vector space to the Virasoro algebra. So we can label them using the same symbols. Okay.
Sorry, what did you just say is isomorphic to the Virasoro algebra?
No, I say that this part of the group corresponding to the momentum translation, the algebra of that group is isomorphic as a vector space to the Virasoro algebra.
Oh, it's a vector space.
Yeah, but it's not isomorphic in the algebraic sense because it has a commutative, a commutative algebra. So that is why I put this C label. Okay, the Virasoro algebra can be represented by an element of the diff S1 together with a central element, R. And the element of the algebra of diff S1 can be represented by vector fields on S1. So a natural basis to write down this algebra would be a Fourier basis, where you take those vector fields to have Fourier components. And here, L and R come from the Virasoro part of the group, so they generate those translations on the horizontal translations associated to translations on the configuration space. And K and T correspond to the momentum translations, generating those vertical transformations. And R and T are the central elements of those algebras. Now, then we can write down the algebra. The one involving L is just the familiar Virasoro algebra. The ones involving K is commutative, but there is this non-trivial mixing between the two.
Rodrigo, hi. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes.
Hi. I have a question. Why you call T the central element of the algebra K? Isn't it the central element by definition should appear in the KK commutator as a level, as a U1 level? And I don't see, I see zero on the right hand side. So I don't understand what is T. Can you explain it again?
Sorry. So T is, in that isomorphism of the Vera C with Vera Sora algebra as a vector space, T is the thing that you would correspond to R. I'm not sure if I understood the question.
I'm just confused about the fact that you call T a central element for the momentum translation algebra, and the momentum translation algebra alone is actually completely abelian. It doesn't have any central extension.
Oh yeah. So yeah. Sorry, I forgot to say.
So I'm just R, confused.
Yeah. Sorry. R and T are central elements of the whole thing. So T and R commute with everything, not just with their own correspondence. So commutator of T with L is also zero.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Okay. So now we can evaluate the corresponding canonical charges on the phase space. The Hamiltonian charge associated to the P's, associated to the L's, recall, those are translations of the configuration space. Those look more like a momentum charge. So that is why I call P. And the Hamiltonian charge associated to the K transformations, which were vertical transformations, they look more like position charges. So I'll call those Q. The two central charges of the whole algebra, they are realized in the phase space as constants, where R is realized as 0 and T is realized as 1. And then when you rewrite the algebra in the Poisson, when you write the Poisson algebra for those charges, you get this. Note that interestingly, the central element of the Virasoro part got removed, so we got back to the diff algebra on the translations of the configuration space. But something non-trivial, so there is a remaining central charge that survived in the mixed bracket between the Q's and P's.
Why is R put to zero?
Sorry, what?
Why is R put to zero?
No, it's not put to zero. It's when you compute, it's put to zero in such a way that you still have a homomorphism between the algebras. If you put it not to zero, you'd have to, it would not be a homomorphism, but a homomorphism only up to central extensions.
Also this VMS algebra, there is like this, there is some, not Einstein gravity, but some theory that have a gravitational anomaly where you have a central charge in then the PP bracket. And I was wondering whether you could also, I mean, why is like, maybe I didn't understand why you get VMS 3, Einstein, like the group you get in, at some sort of very flat in three dimension group, and maybe not another one when you could have this central charge. I mean, maybe I'm losing with the physics behind here.
Yeah.
I don't know if whether you can explain why you get VMS 3 and whether it's like you were expecting that, or whether you would maybe expecting to keep this R non-zero. Because there is also the realization of or the group is R non-zero as an asymptotic group of symmetry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not that I was expecting this, but, and I don't know if I can say this in very few words, but it's similar to if you're doing the same thing for, let's say, quantizing a particle on a line, the naive group you would get is the translation group on that phase space, but when you, if you use that group, you see that there is a central extension. So you have to repeat the procedure with the Heisenberg group instead of the translation group. And at the algebraic level, you would have something like the, let's say, the generators of X. Let's call it K would be the analog of the generator of X. And the generator of P would be the analog of the generator of at the algebra level, you have this something, the commutator is equal to the central element C. But when you realize this on the phase space, And suppose you make a choice. You say that k will be my x, and l will be my p. And then when you compute this, you get something specific, right? You get 1. And then you're going to say, well, this Casimir is realized as the number 1. So it's something similar that happens there. So it depends on particular choices of those charts, because those charts can only be chosen up to a constant. But you want to choose constant so that you have a true representation, a true homomorphism without central, extra central elements appearing.
Maybe I can put a question here, because a few slices back, you said, oh, we couldn't find a representation which leads to that. So I choose to look at Virasoro.
Yeah.
So does it mean there is no such representation which would have given you the original group and you were forced to go to Virasoro? Or is there some choice there which you could have done and would have changed?
Yeah, my claim is that I could not find any such representation.
But you don't know whether there exists such a
representation. Yeah. The only yeah, that's true. The thing that is curious is that after you do all this, you see that that central charge that you introduce is not adding anything to this algebra, that this is the diff algebra. But it is having some effect that it's introducing a central charge in this mixed bracket.
Can I make just a comment, sorry?
Yes.
I believe, I don't know why. Let me rephrase, sorry. I was expecting to get this algebra. Why we are surprised by that? We solved Einstein equations. We didn't solve some modified gravities equation or some generalized equation. So that goes back to Celine's comment. And I was just wondering whether I'm missing the point myself. But I believe that this is perfectly compatible with the original expectation. We found BMS3 algebra with exact the shape and form that happens to asymptotically flat spacetimes and non-infinity with Einstein equations and not with some modified theories.
You start with ADS, no?
ADS or...
Yeah, but you are ADS, we are on ADS on the null hypers. And the presence of BMS on null hypers nowadays, I think it's a perfectly established result. So I'm not surprised. I mean, when you take a Einstein equation and you project them to the horizon of a black hole in 3D, you get BMS3 algebra. So with this shape, not with the Virasoro. So I wanted to understand whether I should be surprised.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you should be surprised. I was surprised because I didn't know, but
okay.
Maybe there's a more, yeah.
Maybe this is too obvious to say, but even though I missed the beginning, I know what he said, I think, more or less. So Rodrigo's analyzing the system using a space-like foliation of the domain of dependence of the diamond, right? So for him, the null surface you just mentioned, Luca, is not, you know, playing any direct role, any evident role in the development up to this point. So what you're saying, I would have to interpret not as that it's obvious that Rodrigo should have wound up with a BMS algebra acting on a space space, but rather that it might be that what he did could be reinterpreted using maybe the null surface as his Cauchy surface and reformulating the analysis. In other words, it might turn out to not be surprising once you reformulate, but at the level of what Rodrigo did, there's no reason to have anticipated a BMS algebra. I think that's...
I see. Thanks a lot. I think that helps.
Yeah. Okay, cool. What is this? Oh, yeah. Okay, so just to mention, discuss a simple observable, which is the charge P naught. So this corresponds to the SO2, subgroup of diff S1.
P is N or Q? Okay.
Sorry, what?
P is N? Okay.
Well, P...
You sure where you change it?
Yeah.
Is it the same thing as L?
Yeah, P is the thing associated to, generated by L. Yeah. So it's part of the diff group, and it's actually the S corresponds to the SO2 subgroup. So it's it deserves the name spin. It also corresponds to the ADM generator of diffuse that act as isometries of the corner. So from that perspective, P naught is just what you would call the spin of this diamond. But by looking at its geometrical interpretation, we see that P can also be related to another quantity, which is, I mean, can be related to a geometrical quantity, which is called the twist of the corner of the diamond. And it's related in this way. So L is the total length of the corner, and this C is the twist, which I will define. So if you have a loop embedded into a three-dimensional space, the twist is essentially the integral with respect to the proper length along the loop of the torsion. And the torsion essentially tells you if you put a frame on this loop and you start moving this frame, which is attached to this curve, the rate that it's rotating around the loop will be the torsion. And the integral of this is the twist. There's another nice interpretation for the twist, which is it relates to a holonomy on the normal bound of the loop. So if you start with this frame aligned with the loop, and you do your best to parallel transport this frame along the loop. And by do your best, I mean you do the Fermi-Walker transport. When this comes back to the original position, the normal directions may be boosted with respect to the original frame. And this boost angle is precisely equal to the twist. Okay, so let me just make a few comments about the quantum theory. So the quantum theory, as we see, should be based on some unitary, irreducible representation of this canonical group. And G is, the BMS, is a semi-direct product of a group, Virasoro, with an abelian factor. So we can, in principle, apply Mackey's theory of induced representation. And a lot of work has been done not so long ago by Oblak on characterizing representations of BMS3. But essentially, the result of Mackey's theory is that a representation is given by basically wave functions on a quadrant orbit of Virasoro, or of the group, which in our case is Virasoro, with labels on some unitary irreducible representation of the little group corresponding to that orbit. The little group meaning the group that fixes a particular point in that orbit. So it's not just basic C-valued wave functions, but the wave functions may take values on those little Hilbert spaces. The most basic choice is to take the orbit as being equal to our configuration space. We know that this is one of the orbits of the quadrant orbits of Virasoro. And in that case, the little group would be PSL times R, where R is just the central element of Virasoro. And it should be in any little group. Now, we also want to realize, to particularize representations where the Casimirs have their proposed values. So T should be realized as 1 and R as 0. This is compatible with T being 1. And if you impose that R is equal to 0, that implies that you should pick the trivial representation for this R factor. So in summary, the representation would be given by wave functions on diff-S1 mod PSL with labels in unitary irreducible representations of PSL. Okay. We can also study the representation from the just by looking at the algebra. Just a quick note here, those operators are not supposed to be self-adjoint because they correspond to classical observables that are not real, because they were defined using Fourier components things like e to I and theta. So they are not real, but they satisfy classically a reality condition, which should be mimicked by the adjoint condition. So the adjoint of Pn should be P minus n, and analogously for Q. Okay, so we can apply this to the P naught that we have discussed. We first note that all the Pn's and Qn's act as a ladder operator for the P naught. And since those operators are supposed to be represented irreducibly, we can conclude that the spectrum of P naught has this particular form. So it's multiples of h bar, where n is an integer and s is some real number between 0 and 1. The time evolution Hamiltonian, evolving between CMC slices, it had a time reversal symmetry. So if we assume that this symmetry is realized in the quantum theory, that implies that the spectrum of P naught should be equal to the spectrum of minus P naught. And that implies that S should be either 0 or 1 half. And then the conclusion would be that the twist, using that relationship to geometrical quantity, the twist, should be quantized in this ratio involving the Planck length to the, so integer or half integer multiples of this ratio of Planck length to the loop length. It's interesting to note that in the limit where the loop length is much bigger than the Planck length, the stepping in this quantization goes to 0, which is compatible with our classical intuition. Okay. So how much time do we have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
So we have time for discussion.
Okay, so let me just very quickly mention this. So the P charges, we discussed the P naught, which had such a simple geometrical interpretation. We also have simple geometric interpretation for all the other Pn's. But the Qn's, the geometrical meaning of them are still a mystery. We know explicitly a formula for them in the abstract variables of the reduced phase space. We also know certain properties that they should satisfy when expressed in physical variables. But we still don't have a clear and simple geometrical meaning.
So n is the length of the loop itself, it's not an observable.
Yeah.
But you have it as a parameter.
Yeah, sorry, what is the question?
The length of your loop. I mean, that's not an observable because you actually fixed,
yes.
Fixed the boundary.
Yes, that is not an observable. But the Q charge is something. It has some, for example, interesting properties. For example, it can show that both classically and quantum mechanically, it's bounded from above by 2 pi, but not bounded from below. And we know, for example, that the state that maximizes Q naught would be a wave function that is concentrated at the PSL class of the identity. But we don't have a very nice geometrical interpretation for the meaning of the Qs. Very recently, I don't think I have time to say this, but it's still speculation, so I should not mention this, but there's some hints that perhaps they're related to expansion parameters of the null rays on the causal on the horizons of the causal diamond. Okay, so to summarize, we consider 2 plus non-pure gravity with a non-positive cosmological constant in the domain of dependence of topological disks with fixed induced corner metric. Using a constant mean curvature gauge for time, we solved the constraints and eliminated the gauge ambiguities and found that the reduced phase space is the cotangent bundle of DFS1 mod PSL2R. The time the Hamiltonian generating time evolution between CMC slices corresponds to the area of the particular CMC, but it depends in a complicated way on the reduced phase space variables. We applied Isham's group theoretic method of quantization and found that the group to be quantized would be BMS3, and Mackey theory would then give that the representations are wave functions on coordinate orbits of Virasoro with labels in unitary reducible representation of the corresponding Lyrow group. And we also found this simple result relating the quantizing the twist of the diamond corner loop in multiple integer or half integer multiples of this quantity involving the Planck length to the loop length. Some operating questions. One is very general, is what is the nature of a quantum causal diamonds? We know that classically every classical state corresponds to a particular global shape of a diamond embedded into ADS. But quantum mechanically, since the variables do not commute, that interpretation fails. Another question is, what is the quantum dynamics of the diamond? So we have described essentially a kinematical, non-perturbative kinematical quantization of the diamond. So essentially we found a Hilbert space which realizes this set of canonical operators. But we don't have a specific representation for the Hamiltonian, the time evolution Hamiltonian, generating evolution between CMC slices. Another one is, what is the geometrical meaning of the Q charges? Why they have been difficult to understand? There's this recent idea that I mentioned, but that is still a speculation. And finally, it would be nice to see how this connects with other approaches, like edge mode stories, how this, this causal diamond can be seen as some sort of subsystem of a larger quantum space-time. Can we promote that statement about twist quantization to some more general statement about loops in ADS, or is it something very specific to this setup, like a causal diamond, which we have treated as being the whole space-time? Other questions that were like original motivations is, could we obtain like finite entropy if we fix certain parameters, for example, the spin and the energy, or the spin and Q naught? So those are pairs of commuting variables. That are just some questions. Yeah, thank you.
Let's start by student question. Yeah. Also one
time. I have a vague comment. No. I'm coming from a different background. But in quantum Hall effect, when you look at impedance in quantum Hall effect, the bulk is supposed to be like a topological field theory, and there are matter in the edges. So interestingly, Aldrin has a quantum geometry theory of quantum Hall effect, which has some connection to quantum gravity. And then you showed some shift of the spin when you quantize the spin at some, you added a parameter S plus N. There is was such a thing also appears.
Oh.
And it has some meaning. I vaguely remember, I can tell you the reference.
Yeah, sure, would I like
there
to.
There is some, I mean, I'm an outside, but I see some vague connection.
Yeah, sure. Would I like to hear more about that?
Other question?
I have a question about, so there is some Hilbert space coming out of your quantization. Is there some complete basis of states, some kind of form of the expansion of the identity, or the composition of some completeness, other statements on this?
Yeah, so there's an ambiguity in choosing the Hilbert space, which is both in choosing the quadrant orbit that you're going to base your wave functions, and also on choosing the irreducible representation of the Lyrow group. But for each of those choices? Assuming that Mackey's theory applies, because it might be tricky, because I think technically Mackey's theory is only properly proven for finite representation of finite dimensional algebras or groups. So if you assume that that applies, then that should correspond to all representations, irreducible representations of that group.
So in the same way, the answer is yes. There is some formula where you can write complete basis of states.
Yeah.
So you said that somehow you are grading your representation by the action of Q, P0, right, or Q0. So you are saying that it's kind of like grading operator which grades your representation, right? You're saying that like for any n, you have a vector which is corresponding charge, right?
Sorry, are you talking about the spectrum of this?
Yeah, this part. So you are saying that you, for any n, like for any integral n, you have a vector to this end, right?
Yeah.
But like typical representations of like Virasoras, they are growing in like in one direction. So like Verma module, for example, you are taking some high space vector and then you're growing like the whole tower of vectors from it. And it typically goes in one side. And if like at least the representations corresponding to some physical modules in the form of your theory, like you have only like one sided tower of states, not two sided. In this case, it looks like you have unbounded from below energies in your theory.
Yes. For P0, yes, that is like the spin. I think it's somewhat similar in Virasoras, right? So, like the angular momentum can go either way, but the energy.
Uh-huh.
So, the energy would be in that setting more analogous to the Q0. And the Q0, we do have a bound on one side.
And Q0, it has not discrete but continuous spectrum.
Yeah, it has a continuous spectrum.
So is it the piece which I can understand as how the boundary curve is embedded in EDS?
Can you say again?
You had the twist as one example, which I'm trying to understand. Is it more, can I understand it as describing how the boundary curve is embedded in EDS?
Yes, yes.
And so all the P's are rather how the boundary curve is embedded in
EDS.
Yes. That's what I would naively call boundary gravitons.
Yeah.
And the Q's are somehow the dynamical, the momenta conjugated to this.
Yeah, well, I think both Q and P together are needed to determine the curve. So
uh-huh.
You can think that.
So it's not that it's like the time evolution.
Yeah, no.
It's not the velocity of the.
Yes, yes. They only describe the.
Only Q and P together which determine the geometry.
Yeah, so that is why my question is, what is the meaning of the quantum thing? Because they do not commute, so you cannot reconstruct meaningfully a space-time from those states?
With an EDS, yeah, it's basically you can introduce some observable, which is like the distance from some center to the boundary. And that gives you something similar to embedding of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, you can think of Q and P as the two directions you can wiggle the curve, so essentially P controls like how it now we can go back to some pictures that I didn't explain what I meant by pre-momentum, zero momentum. So the momentum, so if you pick like a trivial diffeomorphism, but you just go up along the fiber, you kind of control how the curve wiggles in like a time-like direction. And in the other hand, if you pick like a zero momentum and you just change the diffeo, so the Q's, then it controls how it wiggles in space-like directions.
infinity, can you take an infinite disk? Is there some limit of your procedure which describes whole of this?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question. I don't know how to take this limit because in a sense, I mean, if you just take like something that looks mostly round and you take the limit of L going to infinity, it seems that you should recover like a patch of ADS.
Can wiggle.
Yeah, it can wiggle. But the thing is, some states, depending on how you take the limit, some states can also correspond to a curve that is like, has a very squeezed corner. And I don't see how those directions would correspond to anything here.
Maybe, yeah, if the Q's characterize like the shape, maybe you can take the limit holding something constant.
Yeah.
About the Q's.
Yeah, so,
like
yeah, if somehow you can make the limit where you essentially hold this condition that the thing is mostly round, so every direction goes to infinity as you think, then I would expect to relate to like ADS.
You mentioned the Hamiltonian near a round flat disk is, you put free in quotes. So is it possible to, like when you perturbatively study states near the flat round disk, can you study whether the Hamiltonian is bounded below? And if so, like what the vacuum, what the ground state looks like? What can you say anything about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure because so the Hamiltonian, at least classically, it is bounded from below, but it has no minimum, right? Because it's the area of the CMC slices, so it's something positive. But if you like squeeze the diamond, if you squeeze the corner, either in this way or like in this way, you get a limit where the area approaches zero. So
as you leave the almost flat round disk, you can get a lower energy by getting out of that approximation.
Yeah.
Which might be opposite from what you would have thought.
Yeah.
And then it's bounded below, but you can't achieve the lower bound by any configuration.
Yeah. Yeah, so in that sense, it looks a bit like Liouville theory.
Any other questions?
Well, maybe just a remark. Here's something we recommended. It would be nice to extend this quantization where somehow the length operator and the modes of the length is also included as quantization to make an action with other approach of probability, which kind of focuses on that operator as one of the key elements. So do you have any idea? I mean, we discussed a lot, you know, at some point where in the process would you have to go back and kind of extend to include the geometry of the curve itself
Yes. Yeah, if you want to describe the total length as an operator, you would have to drop that boundary condition. Many things would go different. In particular, one of the first things I mentioned is that boundary condition implied that all the formations of foliation are gauge. In general, transformations that change the angle of the boundary may actually be a symmetry. But in that case, you may not get all charges integral. especially charges that deform the boundary in normal directions. And in this setting where we fix the boundary condition, that in a trick way, which is part of that speculation that I mentioned, you can combine diffuse with the gauge fixing constraint, which generates a Vio transformation, because the gauge fixing constraint something like k minus k zero. So this essentially generates Vio transformations on both the metric and the extrinsic curvature. And so diffuse alone would generally violate the boundary condition if you try to do normal deformations. They would have changed the boundary metric. But now that you have this as a constraint, you can combine diffuse with these Vio generating things in such a way that it always compensates whatever the diffuse does to the metric. This can correct to keep it fixed. So there are many points where this condition appears, but I agree that it would be interesting to generalize this to arbitrary boundary metrics.
Okay, I think we can actually go. That's going to still be at PI, so if you want to bother him with question, okay.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much.